Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'd like now to welcome to the program Eric Maddox. He's writer and director with Terra Obscura Films, and he is doing a project called Virtual Dinner Guest Project. The inaugural event is this Friday, the 8th of July at 7 o'clock at Santa Fe Complex. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So this is a virtual conversation between residents of Santa Fe, New Mexico and Ciudad Juarez, Mexico. What's going on?
That's correct. This is the beginning of what I hope to be a broader international global initiative. It's the closest international border, so that in a sense is part of why I selected Mexico as the first country to participate. It's kind of a natural outgrowth of some projects I've already been working on. I've been working on a documentary that deals with immigration border enforcement policy in the U.S.-Mexico border the last couple of years. Through some of the contacts that I've made in the course of making that film, I came into contact with this family that lives in Ciudad Juarez. And
tell us about this family.
Well, as many people, or as people may be aware that have been following what's been going on in Mexico, and more specifically along the Mexican border for the last few years, since 2006, Juarez is kind of a focal point. The violence there is particularly nasty. Of the, 40,000 plus deaths that have taken place since Calderon declared his war on drugs in 2006, roughly 20% of those have taken place just within Juarez. And depending on who you talk to, whether it's an expert or just individuals on the street, the explanation as far as the motives for that violence kind of just run the gamut. And it can be really difficult to come up with like a clear and concise analysis of why. What are the real drivers for the violence that are taking place there right now? So I've decided with my limited resources to just kind of focus on a family, use their perspective. And their perspectives are many and varied. They have different experiences just by virtue of having some of them lived in the United States for a while. They're different ages. They come from different backgrounds. And so they each kind of have their unique narrative, but it's manageable. It's kind of looking at the issues that are facing that city that are very kind of geopolitical in nature as far as their drivers through the eyes of a family living in the midst of that violence.
So far, I mean, just to prepare us for this event, what are some of the multiple interpretations of the violence in Juarez that they're telling you?
Sure. There are, I guess, a couple of larger competing narratives for who is getting killed and why as a result of the cartel wars that are taking place there. Essentially, with just to back up and maybe give like a brief description of what's actually happening, there's a war between the drug cartels that's taking place in Juarez right now for control of the more or less the legal ports of entry into the United States. Depending on who you talk to, 80% of the illegal drugs that are flowing north from Mexico are coming through the legal ports of entry, not through the desert. NAFTA has played a role in that. There's just no way to check the volume of traffic that's coming through. So it's just kind of worth the risk to just load up a truck, and if one out of so many gets through, it's still pay dirt for the cartels. They're killing each other over access to the bridges that connect Juarez to El Paso. And there have been a significant number of civilian casualties. Now,
but why are they killing so many young women? I mean, the stories of teenage girls working in these factories.
That's a great question, and there are a number of different answers to that question, and I'm not sure that I can tell you which one's closest to the truth, or if there really is just one answer. The family that I've talked to has told me, look, some of these women are actually being trained to be drug runners and gun runners, that they provide the perfect cover. They're the last people anyone would suspect. That doesn't explain the fact that they've been finding women's bodies in the desert surrounding Juarez for years.
Yeah.
And at first they were kind of characterized as like disappeared prostitutes, sex workers. And there's been plenty of evidence to suggest that that's not true at all.
That's not true either. I mean, a lot of them seem to be young factory workers on their way home.
And I've spoken with the mothers of some of these women. And and heard their frustrations about trying to get any kind of reasonable investigation underway. And it is tragic. As best I can tell, it might just be another symptom of the general lawlessness and social decay that's kind of come to define the social dynamics in that city. The family that I've been speaking to, an uncle was kidnapped, and not by members of a cartel, as best they can tell. It was just opportunistic thugs that held him for a day, demanded what in cartel terms was kind of a pittance, and released him within a few hours. It was a terrifying ordeal for the family to go through, you can imagine. But I asked them, why are you sure? This sounds like cartel kind of violence, right? This sounds, I mean, so often the narrative you hear in the mainstream media is bad deeds done in Juarez must have something to do with drugs. The cartels are in charge of the drug industry, so they must be linked. And I'm hearing from this family not so much the case, that they're pretty well established, and they're not going to waste their time and resources with a nickel and dime operation like kidnapping of kind of just a regular Joe. They go after big businesses, and they're in it for the big dollars.
Right.
So, yeah, there's opportunistic thuggery, there's highly organized crime, and somewhere in the mix, there is the federal police. There's the municipal police, which seems to kind of change its pants every 5 minutes. A few years ago, they did a screen, like a truth screening, and fired, I think, something like 300 members of the local police department because they failed polygraphs and other integrity tests. So corruption is rampant, and the military is involved there too, and you kind of see just an admixture of all three of those elements patrolling the streets. And some people think it's making a difference, some people don't, and just see them as a frustration, or even worse, like a part of the problem. I was pulled over the last time I was down there, and they tried to extort money from us. This is the police force, the local police force.
Right. Though that's been true in Mexico since as long as I've been conscious. Mm-hmm. And also, for travelers to Mexico, which not so many people are doing these days, but if you give one person the money that they're trying to extort from you, then they call all their friends all the way down the highway, and you're you're screwed, basically, till you get to wherever you're going.
The lady that I was with, I think, is very cognizant of that fact. She, my fixer, if you will, my driver, the contact person that I have, her husband lives in Juarez. She, during the week, lives in the United States and commutes every weekend, sometimes during the week, to Juarez to visit with her husband and her kids. And so driving across that border is a part of her commute. And we were pulled over. The guy kind of said, how can we fix this? How can we make this go away kind of thing? He saw me taking pictures, and that probably kind of highlighted me as someone that might have money. And she just said, you tell me how we should handle this through proper channels. And she had to surrender her driver's license.
So that's what happened?
He said, I can take your plates or I can take your license, or we can take care of this right now. She said she's not going to contribute to the problem. I've talked to many Mexicans or immigrants coming from Juarez or other places in Mexico, and they said, look, like, we play a part in the corruption. Like, if we pay that extra $10 to, like, expedite some sort of bureaucratic process or pay off a cop, we're saying that it's okay. We're participating in the hypocrisy.
So then she had to go get a new license.
Well, I guess the silver lining-ish is she said it was expiring in like a few days anyway, so who cares?
We're talking to Eric Maddox about the Virtual Dinner Guest Project, which is taking place this Friday at Santa Fe Complex at 7 in the evening. So what actually are we who show up at the Santa Fe Complex going to do?
Yeah. Okay. The actual Virtual Dinner Guest Project, as it unfolds, will look a little bit different than what it's going to look like this Friday and the first couple of runs. I'm trying to create a buzz around the project, so I want a larger audience to kind of see the potential. But really, it's supposed to be kind of an intimate affair. You have maybe half dozen people at most sitting around a table conversing with, doesn't have to be Mexico. I have Israel and Palestine lined up for August, and I'm talking to someone from Sudan and people from Afghanistan as well currently. The idea is, say you take an art gallery or the complex, some public venue or private venue, convert it into a dining establishment for an evening, and you give people advance notice, give them an opportunity to make a dinner reservation with people on the other side of the planet. They pay X number of dollars. In this case, it'll be free, but down the road, people will pay X number of dollars for a plate of food that's representative of that culture, that culture's cuisine, and the money goes towards some previously identified grassroots initiative in that country and to cover some of the overhead costs of the project.
Very nice.
So the complex, we're going to have an audience. We're going to have maybe like 4 to 6 people sitting around the table conversing with this family, but it's open to the public. People can kind of sit horseshoe style around this smaller conversation and just kind of witness it, and there'll be a Q&A at some point.
So you'll be on Skype?
Yeah, for now.
And what will be the translation facilities?
Most of the initiatives I've been discussing, other than the Mexico one, I'm dealing with people that speak English.
Oh, okay.
So that's not so much an issue. The Israelis, the Palestinians are speaking to fluent English. I have a person that's bilingual on the other end of the Skype conversation. There's at least one member of the family that speaks fluent English as well, and there are some that don't speak any English. And I have translators on this end as well. I guess I should say interpreters.
Yeah.
So there'll be interpreters on both ends. And, you know, this is going to be a test case. It may be a little bit clunky, it's as much an opportunity for me to see what doesn't work and to try and refine the concept as anything else. We'll be soliciting audience feedback for sure.
Right. Now, you're encouraging restaurant and gallery people to attend?
Yes. Restaurants because, this is part of food culture. I think food and music are maybe second only to language in as far as communicating culture. And part of the reason that I've chosen food as a forum for like international relations is that it's somewhat politically innocuous. A dinner table
right.
can be a place where you have heated debate, but it can not be that. It can be a place where you just have your mouth full and you can't talk.
You just have heated chili.
Exactly. So that's the idea. If you look at somebody's dinner table, you may not share a common word with them from a linguistic standpoint, but just from looking at somebody's table in another culture, you can tell the socioeconomic statuses, how much food they have on the table, right? You can tell something about the role of women. Are the women serving the men or seated at the table with the men? How many generations live in the home? Are they religious? Did they pray before their meal? And that's before anyone has shared a common word.
Right.
So food, music, I think, are powerful cultural communicators, and that's why that was chosen. And restaurants, I think this is good PR for them. It's obviously relevant. They're dealing with food, and this puts food in kind of a positive social light for them, and having their name associated with could be a good PR campaign for them. And the same with galleries. It generates foot traffic. It's a socially progressive initiative, and I've already had some interest there.
So you're hoping that events like this in the future can take place in restaurants or galleries?
There's already plans.
Yeah.
Restaurants, that may be a little complicated. Definitely open to the idea. If somebody's willing to provide me with a venue, I'll jump on it. But galleries are more what I've been pursuing. So kind of making the rounds on Canyon Road and elsewhere. Zane Bennett Contemporary Art has already offered to provide their space for events in August and beyond.
Excellent. Well, the event is virtualdinnerguest.com. Eric Maddox is organizing all of that. He's writer and director, filmmaker with Terra Obscura Films. Anything else you want to let people know before we go?
Yeah, I think the idea is that we have enough expert opinion on many of the issues that are facing people from a global conflict standpoint, and that this isn't that. This is an opportunity to talk to people, and I'm focusing on conflict countries, but talk to people and see them as more than just the face of their conflict.
Right.
And the idea is that if you start with kids really young and give them this kind of exposure, but also adults, whoever, people from all sectors of society, I think it's a little bit harder to ignore people, their problems, their grievances, once you've broken bread with them. It's a pretty simple principle.
Yeah. And when you get to know people one-on-one and you form friendships, all sorts of things can happen, all sorts of understandings can happen that don't happen even if you are a PhD professor of some subject where you haven't formed those personal relationships, at least in my view.
Absolutely. This is about cultivating a culture of informed compassion instead of just hearing about the crisis du jour, if you will, on the news and just feeling bad and changing the channel. If you're emotionally invested in someone's outcome and someone's life prospects, I think you're more likely to act and take it upon yourself to inform yourself before you act.
And also counter stereotypes when they come up in conversation.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Eric Maddox, thanks so much for being with us. If you want to find out more about Virtual Dinner Guest, you can go to virtualdinnerguest.com and also check them out on Facebook. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
I'm happy now to welcome to the cafe Mary Lance. She is producer and director of the film Blue Alchemy, Stories of Indigo, which is premiering tomorrow night, Wednesday, the 6th of July at 7 o'clock. It's a benefit for International Folk Art Market. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's very nice to be here.
So this whole film, it's a documentary about indigo, the plant, the color, the process, the politics, the whole thing. How did you get into this whole question of what is indigo and its many manifestations?
Well, the first time I got, how I actually got hooked with indigo is that I, when I lived in New York, I went to a lecture on textiles in the late 90s, and the person who gave it showed some images, some slides of indigo dye vats, and I learned a little bit about indigo then, and what I learned was that when indigo fibers come out of the vat, they're not blue. They don't turn blue until they hit the air and oxidize, and then the color suddenly turns from kind of a greenish brownish dull greenish brownish color to blue, and that was struck me as being a very magical thing. So I started reading about indigo and studying indigo, and decided that someday I would make a documentary about it. I mean, I was already a documentarian, but it took a while to get around to addressing the topic.
Now, indigo basically comes from a plant which is found on many different continents, and apparently it evolved, the use of indigo color evolved independently in a bunch of different places.
Yes, that's right. That's what scholars believe, and it's really amazing that it did develop independently, because it's pretty hard to figure out how people discovered the process of making a dye from these plants. It's various plants. Certain plants have indican, which is the chemical compound indican, in them, and they're in various plant families, and not all of the same. The plants in one plant family have it. You know, certain ones do, and certain ones don't, and certain ones don't have enough to make indigo dye. So it's, but nonetheless, and to make the dye, you have to go through a fairly complex series of steps in a dye vat. But yet, ancient peoples figured it out, you know, across the warm band of the world. And there is another, there's a kind of indigo plant, or an indigo-related plant called woad, that grows in northern climates. So that's that was the blue dye that existed in Europe until tropical indigo started to be imported there.
So tropical indigo makes a stronger and richer blue, is that correct?
Well, they all make various blues, various shades of blue. Until chemical dyes were invented, all the blue dyes, textile dyes in the world, came from indigo plants. So it dyes a range of colors from pale blue to very, very dark, almost black blue. And but tropical indigo, the indigofera plants and some of the others, dye more different kinds of fibers in a better way. You know, that it adheres really well to cotton in particular. And it's kind of the history of the textile trade comes into this, because, you know, with the Industrial Revolution, suddenly there were mills, lots and lots of mills in Europe producing cotton textiles, and they needed a lot of dye. So dyes became very, well, always were, and then became incredibly valuable and much sought after. So a lot of the colonial powers in the world, the Spanish, the Dutch, the French, the English, were growing indigo at you know, in their colonies, that in warm places where it grew well. That led to some bad labor practices, to say the least. And there's a strong link between indigo and slavery, actually, in this country and in the Caribbean islands and other parts of the world.
Which we can talk about in a moment, because that's definitely part of the whole history of indigo. How far back does it go? What is the oldest actual example of indigo that has survived, indigo dyed fabric, and how far back is it thought to go as a cloth dyeing process?
Well, I don't think anyone knows how far back it goes. The oldest textile, I believe the oldest textile that is known to be dyed with indigo is, one of them is in the British Museum, and it's about 3000 BC. So it's ancient, it's very old, but it may well have existed before that. There are some textiles in the film that we filmed at the Textile Museum in Washington that were being traded from India, which was one of the very early places to use indigo and masterfully used lots of dyes, traded from India to Europe in the Middle Ages, in the 1100s, 1200s, 1400s. There were some textiles that were excavated in Egypt that were part of this trade that went from India to Europe. So it started coming into Europe fairly early, but it really became widely seen in Europe in when the big trade routes opened up between India and in Europe in the late 1500s and 1600s.
Now, in your film, you show places in India and Japan, Mexico, Central America, Africa. How did you choose these places? In other words, are these the kind of epicenters of indigo art and craft and the places that have taken this process to its greatest manifestation?
Well, some of them are. India certainly is. But the film is called Stories, Blue Alchemy Stories of Indigo, because apart from explaining what indigo is and how it works and telling about the history, I wanted to tell stories about certain people and certain groups and organizations in different parts of the world that are using indigo in interesting ways, either people who have been using indigo all along as part of their culture or people who are reviving indigo. And it doesn't represent all the places in the world where indigo exists. There are many more. But these were stories of people in groups that I found out about gradually over the time of first researching and then actually working on the film. We started shooting in December of 2005 in Japan with a contemporary textile artist named Hiroyuki Shindo, whose work is really beautiful. And I had found out about him by seeing him and some of his work in another documentary several years before that. And then the shooting went on little by little over 5 years, 5.5 years. It's a grant-funded film, so, you know, the money was raised piecemeal, and the production was sort of spread out over a long period of time until I finally managed to raise all the money for the film. But at one point in 2006, I went to India, and we did our shooting in India there in two parts of places in India, in Hyderabad and in Bengal. And I also went to a symposium that was held by UNESCO in Hyderabad, and I met several of the people who were in the film or people who helped me tremendously with information. I met at that symposium, and that was particularly helpful. I met the women from Mexico, Cecilia Jaimes Lino and her mother, Manuela Cecilia Lino, who live in a small village in the northern part of Puebla State in Mexico, and they have a really interesting indigo culture there that's matrilineal. The knowledge of dyeing is handed down from mother to daughter. And also at that conference, Ana Roquero, a Spanish scholar, gave a paper about the women and the indigo culture history in that village. So that's between the listening to Anna's presentation and then having the chance to meet Cecilia, that's how I found out about that that particular story. And it was so it was a series of various kinds of meeting people and finding out. Lots of people were very generous with information and suggested I get in touch with people, and it kind of went on from there.
We're talking to Mary Lance about her film Blue Alchemy, Stories of Indigo. Let's talk a little more about the Mexican indigo story, which is a very beautiful story of you show the process, which is on the one hand a very low-tech process. I mean, these cauldrons with vats of water and this indigo plant, the leaves of it being stirred around, and a fermentation process where a little pail of fermented water is used. It reminded me of yogurt, like you need a little bit of yogurt to start the next batch of yogurt. It's like that with the indigo on some level.
Well, it's like that in that place, in Hueyapan. That's one of the few places where they actually use an indigo starter, and they use the indigo actually goes in as powdered indigo that she grinds up on a metate, a grinding stone, and then other plants that help with the fermentation go in. But they actually do add an indigo starter that they save from one vat to another. And that doesn't happen in too many places in the world, but that's one of the unique things. Different people have different recipes of how to make indigo dye vats. In the film, we show how it's made. How Hiroyuki Shindo makes it in Japan, and he, in addition to indigo compost that he puts in, he pours half a bottle of sake. So yeah. There's always an alkaline element, but sometimes there's also a sweet element that to sort of aid the fermentation.
For everybody, I think almost everybody in the film, there is some spiritual connotation to it as well. There's either a prayer or a little object that's associated with it, or a deity of indigo. That seems to be universal. Is that correct?
It's very cross-cultural that indigo has spiritual connotations, and I don't know why that is, but I have. My guess is that because indigo is, indigo dye vats are hard to do. It's easy for them to fail. You know, you have to have the temperature right, the chemistry has to be right, and I think that over time, a lot of mythology and spirituality grew up around it because there were, you know, people were praying for it to succeed. In some cultures, pregnant women are kept away from the vat, or menstruating women are kept away from the vat because people believe that if they come near it during the time the dye vat is in process, that they'll steal the fertility from the vat. The fermentation won't happen. It's incredibly interesting. But in Nigeria, there's a deity, Iyamapo, a female deity, one of the Yoruba deities. In Mexico, they're... the process, at least in Hueyapan, the process of doing the indigo dye vat is really layered with spirituality, and the sign of the cross is made at various stages. And they put in, we were able to film this, it was just an amazing experience, but Cecilia Jaimes-Lino, who did the vat for us and showed us how the vat is done, they make a little rag doll out of cotton and throw that into the vat. And she explains in the film that it's... she says that there's a connection between indigo and childbirth, and that the little rag doll going in, it's like a talisman actually to make the dye vat succeed in case they run into any pregnant women during the time. You know, it takes several days for it to happen, so they might be out in the market and meet somebody who's pregnant or something like that. So they believe that talisman thrown into the vat will protect the vat and keep it from failing. In Japan, there's a deity, an indigo god, Aizen Shin. Hiroyuki Shindo tells about that deity, and we were there near the end of 2005, and he was preparing his New Year's copy. He makes a beautiful little model on paper of an indigo, the indigo god that the indigo dyers in Japan traditionally put in their Shinto shrines on New Year's Day. So he was making that when we were there. We were able to film him making it. And it was the year of the following year was the year of the dog. So we filmed him painting little pictures of dogs on these beautiful paper, painted paper, kimono shaped indigo gods.
There's a Santa Fe connection in your film. One of our wonderful artists in Santa Fe is Gasali Adeyemo, who is an indigo maker who's always at Folk Art Market, I assume will be this year too, and he contributed to the African part of your film.
He did. Gasali is a wonderful indigo dyer and a terrific person, and I got to know him 3 or 4 years ago when I took a dyeing workshop with him, and I found out that he was a student and then a teacher at the Nikkei Center for Art and Culture in Oshogbo, Nigeria. And I already, by that point, was hoping to be able to include Nikkei Davies and her art center in the film. So when I found out that Gasali really comes from that exact place where the center in the Oshogbo Nikkei Center is located, I was really thrilled, and I kept in touch with him. And then he told me about 2 years ago that he was planning to go home in January of last year, and he would be there for about 6 weeks. And so we talked about it, and we planned our shoot in Nigeria for that time. And he was production coordinator for that part of the film. He set up some of the shooting, and it was really wonderful. I'm so glad to have that sequence in the film, and it would have been very difficult to do it without Gasali's help. And he will have a booth at the Folk Art Market this year, and I hope everybody stops by and visits and looks at his beautiful work.
Yeah, it's incredible, and you can see it here in Santa Fe during Folk Art Market, and you can see it in the film. One of the things that's interesting is during that segment of the film, the Oshogbo Nigerian part of the film, talking about indigo, you get to see the ways in which the fabric is dyed and the resists that they put on it. So the places where they paint these resists doesn't take the dye, and they come out white in those parts, or whatever the color of the fabric is. It's fascinating to watch.
Yeah, the fabric, the Yoruba indigo dye fabric is called adire, and they make various kinds of designs that are symbolic and all have meaning in their culture. And they make these designs by painting on cassava paste, which resists the dye, painting the designs out of that. And then they also do stitch resist. So they stitch various patterns or do a form of tie dye. They tie tiny little circles. And then they dye the fabric after it's been stitched or painted or tied, and then after it comes out of the vat, they take out the stitching, or they take off the cassava paste, and the design remains. Some of it is similar to a technique that's used in Japan called shibori, and they're really, really beautiful fabrics. And I was able to shoot some beautiful old ones. One I actually bought from Gasali at the Folk Art Market a few years ago, but I was able to shoot some other wonderful ones in Nigeria, some of the collection of Nikkei Davies Okundaye, who is a very important figure in Nigeria, in the art world in Nigeria, and she is a painter and a textile artist. And she started she has a series of art centers for them in Nigeria, different parts of the country. The biggest one is in Oshogbo. And they train young people. Indigo dyeing in the Yoruba culture is traditionally a woman's art, but the last several decades, men have been doing it too. And this center trains young men and young women to learn how to do adire textiles and batik textiles and indigo dyeing, and so that they can have a way of earning a decent living. And one of the problems that they have now is that they don't have much of a market, because Nigeria has a lot of problems and not many tourists go there. So it's so great that the folk art market exists and that people have the opportunity to buy work from Ghazali, who's at the folk art market. And I just would like to say a little bit about the value of the market. It's such a treasure, and I'm so happy to have my film associated with it this year as a benefit for them, because it's so important that craftspeople and artists in traditional cultures are able to continue their work, and the only way they can really continue it on a large scale is if they have markets for their work, and the folk art market, it provides that on such a broad scale for so many people. It makes a big difference in people's lives in developing countries. So I hope everyone will go to the folk art market this year.
We're talking to Mary Lance, producer and director of the film Blue Alchemy, Stories of Indigo, which, by the way, will be at the Lensic tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. It's a benefit for International Folk Art Market. There are some other ways that indigo is used to dye fabric. I mean, it's used to dye fabric so that you just have a clean and beautiful blue. There's also some people who use blocks that are used, like wood blocks, that are used to actually print on the fabric.
Yes. Well, block printing is a very old technique of decorating fabric in India and also in Bangladesh, which, of course, once was part of India. It's just east of the northern part of India. And we were lucky enough to film in Bangladesh at two places, at an NGO, a fair trade NGO that produces beautiful textiles called Aranya, and also at another NGO project that is reviving indigo dye production. And at Aranya, we filmed a wonderful block printer doing block printing with indigo, and he has this great big, it looks like a big ink pad. It's a large pad that's soaked with indigo dye, and he, expertly hits his, dabs the block onto the indigo and then blocks. Prints this beautiful, but he was actually printing a silk sari at the time.
Yeah.
It's really quite beautiful. And then we filmed some of the saris that had been printed that way.
It's so interesting, when I was watching the film and thinking about the indigo that I've, handmade indigo textiles that I've seen in my life, whether it be the African Oshogbo ones or East Asian ones or whatever, they all have this quality of that handmade imperfection, which makes them so beautiful. They're not regular, every single line is perfect, machine-made things, and those very tiny imperfections make them just so much more desirable in some funny way.
Yeah, it's true, and many of the works that are shown in the film are handmade by people who are working in cultures where textiles, indigo dye textiles, have been made for a long time, and those do have those unique, really personal qualities. But indigo was used, as we talked about before, as an industrial dye on a large scale. And blue jeans were originally dyed with natural indigo. And
right.
Now they're actually dyed with synthetic indigo, which is it's actually a chemical version. They actually reproduce the exact chemical formula of the plant indigo. And so it's what dyes the blue jeans, all the blue jeans that we wear nowadays, is a synthesized version of the plant indigo.
Well, the film makes me think of something which is interesting. You don't go into it that much, but in Europe, indigo fabric, blue fabric, was very much sought after and something that only royalty could have. And then as it made its way later in history to blue jeans and work clothes, it went from being the color of royalty to the color of the blue-collar worker, literally.
That's right. That's where the term comes from. And because once it became available on a large scale during the Industrial Revolution, the fabrics really were available to everyone, in the West, who benefited from having those textiles. And the indigo is a dye that actually strengthens fabric and makes it strong. So denim can be in various colors, but blue denim became a very, very popular textile for workers' clothing. And that's, how the idea of blue-collar worker evolved.
So In the Western Hemisphere, as you started talking about earlier, indigo production was associated with slavery in the West Indies and in South Carolina. And there was, at one point in Bengal, under the British colonial system, a moment where they were trying to get local workers to plant indigo instead of rice, which meant that they couldn't have enough to eat, basically, because rice was their staple. And there was a whole resistance around indigo, against indigo and against the British.
That's right. In the late 18th century and up until the middle of the 19th century, the British were producing massive amounts of indigo in Bengal, in the northeastern part of India. It's the area around Calcutta, which is now known as Kolkata. And indigo had previously been grown in other parts of India, but when the British made a very large settlement, started to develop this large settlement that became Calcutta, for various reasons, they really expanded the indigo production there. And the system developed that they would be, basically it was a kind of forced labor or forced peasantry growing the indigo, because the landlords were sort of were friendly to the British, and the British had to do the growing of indigo and other whatever other crops they were growing there through the local landlords, and so they were forcing people to grow indigo, and in many cases to the exclusion of rice, so that people were starving, and there was an actual indigo rebellion in the 1850s in Bengal, and it eventually failed, but there was a period of time where people did resist the British and sort of went on strike, and there's some very, very interesting historical material, and we were able to interview a former history professor in Calcutta who tells the story very well. And then when the industrial production of indigo actually went out, when synthetic dyes were invented, when synthetic indigo finally came onto the market around the very end of the 19th century and early 20th century. So in all of these colonial enterprises, and whether they were in Central America or the Caribbean, India, they just basically almost overnight stopped growing indigo in industrial enterprises. And of course, people who did it for their own purposes and for their own use continued doing it and are still doing it in many places today. But during World War I, because the synthetic indigo came from Germany, there was a lack that the source for synthetic indigo for Britain and the USA was cut off because they couldn't get it from Germany. And there was actually a little revival of indigo in Bengal at that time. And again, they were treating the peasants very badly, and that resulted in Gandhi's first civil action in India. After he returned from India to South Africa, his first civil action was on behalf of indigo workers in Champaran in the state of Bihar.
Now, there's also been a resurgence of indigo for ecological reasons. There you show during the film people who were making basically, what would you call it, eco blue jeans.
Yes, that's right. There are various little companies that are doing this, and we focused on a wonderful one that's in southern India, in Tamil Nadu, called The Colors of Nature, and they make really great eco jeans, and they make them, they're made from hand-spun organic cotton that's dyed in, with plant indigo in the traditional indigo dye vats, fermentation vats. And indigo is being revived in various places, and several of them are in places that were formerly, places where the colonial powers were growing indigo. But now it's all for positive. it's all being done by NGOs and by individuals and people that are doing it for ecological reasons or to provide work for people in areas that are developing and don't have enough, you know, well-paid work. So one of the places that we went is El Salvador, where there are lots and lots of small indigo projects. Lots of people, indigo grows really well in El Salvador and Central America. It, of course, had completely died out and been replaced by sugar and cotton by the end of the 19th century. But now people are reviving it. I found out that the first projects to revive indigo were actually started after the recent civil war in El Salvador. People were sort of brainstorming to try and find ways of providing labor, new forms of new ways of people to earn money. So somebody had the idea of trying to start to grow indigo again, and so it started from there. And now there are various projects all over El Salvador where indigo is being grown and indigo dye is being made, and some of them are organic farms.
And so it becomes part of actually a peacemaking process, at least as they talk about it in El Salvador.
That's right, yeah.
Now, there's also micro projects going on all over the place, and as micro lending is kind of a buzzword and a great hope for economic revival in small villages, really all over the world, all over the third world particularly, but in places like New Mexico too, indigo is part of that.
Well, indigo, yeah, people are, I mean, indigo dye can really only be made in places where the plants grow. So for the most part, or maybe even entirely, the people that are dying with indigo in New Mexico are getting it from either Mexico or possibly from El Salvador. They're getting it or from India. It's coming from some other place. But there are some people who are starting to grow the type of indigo that's used in Japan and parts of China, which is in the buckwheat family, and it does grow in colder climates. I mean, Japan gets very cold in the winter. So that's, I don't know of anybody who's growing it in New Mexico, but there are certain, you know, there are some people in different parts of the country who are growing the Japanese indigo. So I just meant
that micro projects in micro lending projects are something that we have here, not indigo specifically.
Oh, right. Right.
So do you do indigo dyeing yourself?
Well, I'm not really a dyer, but I did a project about a year ago where I dyed some cotton string and indigo for an art project that I did. But it is hard. I can say from experience it's not an easy thing to do a fermentation vat. But I really, now that the film is done and I won't be obsessed with getting the film done. That's one of my intentions is to learn how to do a good indigo dye vat.
So you're not tired of it?
Oh, no. No, I really like indigo. I think it's the colors, the various colors that it makes are so beautiful, and it really does have a special quality that's hard to define that draws people to it, I believe. And I think that that's part of the reasons that blue jeans are so popular.
Yeah, exactly. Mary Lance is producer and director of Blue Alchemy, Stories of Indigo, which is going to be screened tomorrow night, Wednesday the 6th of July at 7 o'clock. It's a benefit for International Folk Art Market. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte. Thanks a lot.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.